Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Podcast with me, Matt Chorley. Packed show on my Times Radio show. Today we talked about Scotland with the polling legend Professor Sir John Curtis, who said there was a decent chance of Scotland becoming independent. Alex Massey and Angela Haggerty also locked horns on that one. Comedian Shappi Kossandy told us what she would do if she ruled the world. Labour MP Clive Lewis, not totally clear what his party's policy on wearing face masks is. You can listen to all of that if you want to listen back to the show on the Times Radio app or online. But on the podcast today, we thought we'd bring you a fascinating chat with Mary Beard, the historian and broadcaster, who basically gave me a history lesson, a history class in how we can learn from what the Romans ever did for us in our politics and what the ancient Greeks can tell us about politics today, in particular the Prime Minister's obsession with Pericles and Cicero. So I hope you enjoy it. This is Mary Beard talking to me on my Times Radio show, 10 till 1, Monday to Thursday. So now then on Times Radio, what did the Romans ever do for our politics? And what can ancient history tell us about what is happening today? We've got a Prime Minister who likes to quote Cicero and keeps a bust of Pericles in his office. And a US president, which some have likened to Julius Caesar. But are these parallels useful or not? In our latest history class, I'm thrilled to be joined by Professor Mary Beard, leading scholar of ancient civilization at Cambridge, and frankly, one of the best classicists around. She's also been hosting a culture show from her study during lockdown, and Mary joins me now. Good morning, Mary.
Hello, Matt.
Thank you so much for joining us. Now, I'm putting myself at your mercy here, I have to confess, because this is far from my area of expertise. So assume I know very little and treat me as your sort of your underperforming pupil in all of this.
Right.
So where do we want to start?
Well, I mean, I think with the question you just raised, really, which is, you know, what do the Romans ever do for us, or can we learn from them, right? And I think all those kind of parallels that we love to draw with the Romans, you know, is Trump really like Julius Caesar, or is he like Nero, you know, that kind of question. I think they're immensely good fun, you know, and they help you think about Trump in different ways. I don't think they solve any political problems. I don't think the Romans provide a template for us to work out what to do about Trump. And I think that's the danger. You know, what you don't find if you look back in ancient history, you don't find the kind of the answer. What you find is interestingly different ways of looking at the present. And that for me is good enough.
Is it also sometimes, because we constantly tell ourselves we live in unprecedented times, that actually sometimes, maybe not going all the way back to the Roman, but sometimes reaching for parallels in the past which nations came through is a sort of reassurance sometimes that everything might be all right in the end?
I mean, yeah, and I think you can see that about, you know, plagues and pandemics, really. You know, I think, you know, people often say, people have been tempted to say, looking at some of the terrible plagues there were in the Roman Empire, maybe it was that brought the Roman Empire down, you know, and thinking, and maybe this will kind of, what we're going through will somehow kind of collapse our own political system. I mean, I think it's much better to say, look, actually, the Greeks and the Romans and people of other periods, they survived this stuff. You know, the good news is things might be a bit different, but, you know, total kind of collapse of everything we know doesn't actually follow from some of these terrible pandemics of the past. You know, so, you know, you can be a glass half full or a glass half empty person.
Always glass half full. That's definitely my... Yes. My. So let's go, right, let's start with the basics then, and democracy. And how does what we call democracy differ to how the Greeks or the Romans might have seen it?
Well, the Romans hated democracy. They would never have ever wanted, apart from a few real radicals, that they were very keen on liberty, but they were not keen on democracy. Where you find that what we think of as the origin of democracy, it's in 5th century Athens. And it's only one of many political systems the ancient Greeks had. They would be completely baffled about what we call democracy. And I think one good example to take is that we tend to think that one of the hallmarks of democracy is democratic elections. You know, that you know, we have a right to cast our vote to, you know, choose a government or a president or whatever. Now, if you go back to 5th century Athens, the Athenian commentators appear to have thought that that elections were deeply conservative because it privileged the system of election, privileged those who had the chance and the money to be able to canvass, etc., etc. And if they thought of what the best democratic means of choice was, they would say drawing lots. And in the middle of the 5th century, almost all Athenian political officials, not quite all, but almost all of them, were chosen by lot. And it was seen to be a hugely important step forward, you know, not to let the rich stand for election and bribe the electorate and get voted in.
This feels like a very today sort of debate to be having, is the how do you prevent democracy, politics being dominated by the well-off. Yeah. I mean, I think we're still relatively lucky in the UK, but if you look across to America, where, you know, it's two billionaires locking horns and seeing who can spend as much money as possible.
Yeah, you know, and I think so, you know, in I mean, I'm not saying that we want to go back to an Athenian system, but maybe we do. Jury's out. But I think what's important is for us to see that some of the assumptions that we make about what really underpins democracy is not the simply not the assumptions that the ancient Athenians made. And I think it helps you. I mean, I think looking at this kind of deep history, I think it helps you look at your own society as it were from the outside. I mean, I think you can start to say, just like you did, you know, what would the Athenians have thought about us? Well, they would have thought that we were deeply undemocratic. Even though, you know, the symbol of modern democracy, you know, that you see on the front of newspapers, when elections happen, is the ballot box. They thought that was giving advantage to the rich. And of course, actually, you know, in some ways, we still have bits of that idea in our system. Because, you know, if you think about juries, you know, juries in criminal cases, they're chosen by lot. You know, that is a choice by lot. And we think that's terribly important because you're getting a fair representative sample of, you know, of society. So, you know, it's not, you know, the idea, some Athenian ideas are still with us, even though I suspect that we don't recognise them. And we don't think about juries really as being chosen by lot. We just tend to moan when we get done for jury service. But actually, this is, you know, absolute degree zero democracy.
And what about the question of, and you know, this has been thrown up by recent elections and referendums. We don't need to go into the sort of the particular details, but the idea that people didn't have the facts and actually rhetoric and cheap sloganeering has overridden, you know, people knowing what they were voting on. This is not a new complaint, is it?
It is not a new complaint. And you can go right back to satirical comedy in the 5th century BC Athens to see people making the same kind of complaints, you know, that democracy only works if the people are informed. And there's a terribly famous kind of changing your mind in a referendum debate, because in the middle of the 5th century BC, because the Athenians, who did, you know, vote on legislation, they didn't vote to elect officials, but they voted on legislation. They all got together to vote to put to death all the men and enslave all the women of one of their satellite states who'd rebelled from them, because the Athenians were both a democracy and a pretty tough empire. And they put their hands up and they say, we're going to, you know, as punishment for your rebellion, we're going to slaughter the men and enslave the women. They go home that night, you know, no doubt have quite a bit of ouzo to drink. and they, oh my God, you know, what have we done? So they come together the next morning and they put the vote again. They say, look, maybe we should think again. And the decision is overturned. And then they have to think, but heavens, we've already sent the ship to tell these people that what we're going to do. You know, we've sent the hit squad. But luckily, the hit squad was so gloomy about what they were going to have to do that they were rowing very slowly. So the new ship goes and intercepts them and says, I mean, there was still some pretty brutal punishment, but it wasn't going to be punishment to the death. And Romans looked back to that and Greeks talked about it, you know, as a classic example of changing your mind. You know, democracies are allowed to do it.
That does sound like a pretty good, if elaborate, sort of metaphor for some of the debates which have happened about politics and referendum results and all that sort of thing in modern times. What about the power of speech and oratory?
Yeah.
And the impact that could have on, you know, swaying the electorate, the mob, or whatever it might be.
You know, terribly, terribly worrying. You know, because, you know, one of the key fears that these satiric comedies in the middle of the 5th century home in on is the idea that someone who can make, by speaking, can make the worse argument seem the better.
If you like what you're hearing, you can listen to the whole of my Times Radio show, either listen back on the Times Radio app, or you can listen live Monday to Thursday, 10 till 1. We'll have more on the episode after this.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
And the idea that what persuasion, the idea of the persuasive power of speech could persuade you.
Oh, dear. I think we've just slightly lost.
So.
Oh, no, Mary, sorry, we lost you then. The line just slightly cut out.
One of the things they really worried about was the persuasive power of speech, which could persuade you to vote for the wrong thing. You know, that rhetoric and skills in oratory were not neutral. They persuaded you to do what you shouldn't. And speech is, you know, crucially important in the ancient world. Most people probably are illiterate. And so Greek and Roman commentators are very, very concerned about how you inform and persuade people to do one thing or the other. And there was a real problem about rhetoric. The better rhetorician you were, the more you were likely to persuade people to do things they shouldn't. And I think we've lost that feeling of anxiety about rhetoric.
What you think now we're quite happy to go along with, if someone's a good public speaker or they've got the best slogan, they tend to win the day.
Yeah, or we're not very analytical about how we are being persuaded. This is where I think possibly things like media studies have had a very, very bad press, because maybe they are actually helping kids look at the mechanisms of persuasion and why we're influenced by, whether it's advertisements or politicians or the television. You know, you need to think about, why do I find that guy persuasive? And that, of course, is what the ancients are very good at. I mean, you look now, you know, if you're a student and you're studying the ancient Greeks and Romans, you know, there are pages and pages of, you know, what is rather kind of drearily called rhetorical treatises. And you think, you know, I'd rather not read those, thank you very much. And they do appear to be a bit dull. But they're reaching to an absolutely fundamental issue, which is, that's my phone going, let me turn it off. They're reaching to a fundamental issue of how do words work? How does persuasion work? How do we make our minds up? So I think they've got a lot. They've got a lot not to help us with. I mean, I don't, you know, I couldn't honestly say that, you know, if you read loads and loads of Plato or Cicero, you'll have the answer to today's problems. No, you won't. But you'll have thought about them differently, and you'll have seen that other people, you know, they face these problems too. Our problems are not new problems.
I know, we always like to think that our problems are a sort of new phenomenon of the media or the 21st century, yes, or whatever, and actually it's the same old problems. But knowing that you were coming on, I did try to read up, do a bit of homework before our history lesson. And I came across, and it's something you've spoken about before, a sort of Roman handbook of electioneering, a sort of early early spin doctor. It basically said, don't have any policies because some people won't like them. Don't make any, you can make any promise you like to potential voters, even if you know you can't keep them. Because if you refuse to do what people want, they won't vote for you.
That's exactly, I mean, you know, this is, I mean, I did once, a long time ago, previous election, I did interview Boris Johnson about this handbook of electioneering. And he was very, very taken with it, you know, in terms of, you know, nothing new under the sun, just look at this, you know, here's someone thousands of years ago, and they've sort of nailed what happens now. And of course, you know, of course, you know, there's hundreds and thousands of differences between us and antiquity, you know, the position of women, position of the enslaved, whatever. But ultimately, you know, the basic principles in Rome, particularly, much more so, I think, than Greece. Rome was a very strongly electoral economy. They're very, very similar. And people saw things. You can see the Romans seeing things so damn clearly, you know, like, you know, promise anything because you won't have to deliver it.
Until you seek re-election, I suppose, that's the only downside. You mentioned Boris Johnson. He's obviously, you know, he's got this obsession with Cicero. He quoted Cicero when he came out of hospital a couple of months ago. The health of the people should be the supreme law.
Yes.
What do you make of this? This interest in is it real? Does he really know his stuff, or has he just got a few quotes up his sleeve to impress people like me who don't know enough about it?
I think he is. I could be fair to him, actually. I think he's sincere in his interest in the ancient world. I have no doubt that he cares that people should go on studying antiquity. He's himself interested in it. You know, he's got a bust of Pericles, you know, the 5th century Athenian politician in his study, you know. But rather alarmingly, Pericles died in a plague in Athens. Kind of strange symbol to have now. But I mean, I think the problem for me is that I, you know, wanting to interest loads of people in the ancient world is not that Boris is insincere in his in his enthusiasm for the ancient world. It's just it kind of tends to give the impression that somehow studying classics is a very conservative thing to do. You know, it's Johnson and Rees-Mogg and co. And they and it sort of makes it reinforces the idea that most of us in the profession are trying to get rid of, you know, that classics is an elitist discipline. You know,
it's not very cool if it's
for
Johnson's
old Etonians, yeah, and not for the likes of us, you know. And I think that's the problem I have with it. I disagree with all sorts of interpretations he has about the ancient world. I mean, he hugely admires 5th century classical Athens, and there are things to admire about it. But it was also a pretty brutal place. You know, and God help you if you were a woman. Right? But it's more, I think, that it sort of tends to tar the study of the ancient world with that sort of upper crust Tory brush. And I'm fine that upper crust Tories study the ancient world. I just don't want to be just them.
Yeah, maybe they'd stop talking about it so much to try and change the perception of it.
You know, and it's the kind of the throwing out of little Latin quotes. You know, it makes me want to be sick, really. You know, as if somehow that kind of legitimated what I've said, because I'm just about to throw out a quote that none of you understand. So, and you know, for me, studying the ancient world is about opening up subjects. It's about democratizing us all, not about using it as a kind of gatekeeper to the posh.
I think that's a really good point, because when I must admit, whenever they quote Latin, I don't have a clue what they're talking about. Just for those who don't know, Pericles. You mentioned how Pericles died. Boris Johnson's got this bust of him in his office. What should we know about Pericles to sort of give us an insight into, you know, if someone's got a bust of Winston Churchill in their office, we know what that's all about. What's a bust of Pericles in his office telling us?
Well, Pericles is a very tricky a character. If I was Johnson, what I would say, why do I want to bust a Pericles in my study? He was the person, so far as we can tell, who was one of the most powerful voices for the virtues of Athenian democracy. He managed to draw together, at least in one version of a speech that he gave that we have, he managed to draw together the idea of the politics of democracy with the culture and the philosophy and the art of Athens in a kind of democratic, patriotic vision. You know, it was, you know, Pericles and his friends who commissioned the Parthenon, for example. You know, it's about seeing, you know, the beauty of a democratic political system and using using people's skills and talents and artistic expertise to glorify the homeland. You know, and it's certainly the case that Pericles, who was a very powerful voice in the middle of the 5th century BC, he has long been associated with, and was right back to then, with that kind of sense of the beauty of democracy. Now, fine, that's one side of the story. You know, he was also a pretty brutal imperialist. And, you know, what we do like to forget is that ancient Athens, with its wonderful, in some ways, democratic culture, was busy suppressing its neighbours and imposing its own political system on them. In the end, they go to war about it, and the Athenians lose. And Pericles is a kind of, I mean, just as people now disagree in all kinds of ways, and I think rightly, about, you know, the overview of what Churchill stands for, you know, both good and bad. Pericles is a symbol of Athenian democracy and culture, but with some unpleasant underbelly.
And you mentioned that the Pericles died in a plague. Obviously, you know, the ancient world has been hit by various similar things to what we're going through in the past. To what extent in the past would the people, the citizens, blame their leaders for that sort of thing in the way that we do right now? Or is it blamed somewhere else? Is it the gods or just nature?
They do, up to a point. But they're more likely to blame, A, as you say, the gods. They don't understand in the way that we understand the nature of disease and contagion. You know, they know it comes from somewhere, but where does it come from?
They don't have a Chris Whitty.
They've got a few doctors, but none of them, I'm afraid, at the right hand of the politicians, right? Recommending some pretty odd things too. So, you know, one of the things is to say that plague is brought by the gods. If there's a plague, we have done something wrong. And we've done something wrong often, either against the gods or we have committed a sin the gods want to punish us for. And that's what the plague is. And that's what you see in Greek literature. You know, one of the most famous plays, you know, in the Western world, Sophocles' Oedipus the King, the origin of Freud's Oedipus complex, and goodness knows what else in the modern world. It starts with a plague, and the plague shows you that something in the state has gone terribly wrong because the gods are punishing us. And I think that's probably the most standard thing. I think they're also, you know, this is not a million miles away from Mr. Trump, I'm afraid. They also will blame outsiders. You know, it all came from those nasty Easterners. They brought it. You know, and Trump talking about, you know, the China plague, the China virus, it isn't all that far from what some people in the ancient world used to say about where these pandemics came from.
I could speak to you about this for so long because it's so fascinating. One of the things that really struck me when I was thinking about chatting to you is how many words and phrases have found their way into the sort of political discourse, whether it's like fiddling while Rome burns, crossing the Rubicon, bread and circuses. And if we twisted them all out of their original context so that they're not quite what we think they mean these days.
We're quite good at doing that. Sometimes we use them absolutely rightly. I think fiddling while Rome burns is a very interesting one, because what it refers to is the Emperor Nero, who, when there was a vast fire in the city of Rome, he instead of instantly going and helping, he sat on the outskirts in one of his villas watching the flames and playing his lyre.
Lyre
is the ancient equivalent of the violin or the fiddle. I think what's very, very interesting is that when we use the phrase fiddling while Rome burns, I mean, a lot of people, I think, don't realise that it means playing a musical instrument. They think it means kind of fiddling with a piece of paper, you know, being a bit ineffectual while Rome burns. But it's still a very, very common image. I mean, you can go to, you know, any daily newspaper and look at the last 10 years of cartoons. And, you know, I can pretty well guarantee that there'll be at least two or three which have shown Donald Trump, George W. Bush, Gordon Brown, whoever, you know, sitting there with a wreath on their head, town going up behind them in flames. And, you know, they're sitting there with a guitar or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, just before I let you go, just bringing politics right bang up to date, Gavin Williamson, the Education Secretary, was talking in the last few days about the purpose of education. And saying the purpose of education was basically just to get a job, and you took issue with him.
I did, you know, and as I said in the little tweet, you know, as somebody who's in education, you know, I don't think that employment is irrelevant here. I mean, you know, if I was teaching a load of students, all of whom remained unemployed when they left my university, you know, I think we weren't doing something right. But it's such a narrow, mechanistic view of what education is. It's about thinking differently. It's about helping us to help each other to make the world we live in better. It's not about whether I can get an extra 10k on my salary.
And sometimes it's just nice to learn things for the sake of it, which hopefully is what we've done in the last half an hour.
I hope so. Thank you.
It's been so lovely to speak to you, Professor Mary Beard, there joining us on Times Radio, talking us through in our history class how what the past might be able to tell us about what's going on in politics right now, and basically just confirming our suspicion that there's nothing new that's ever happened, and the same things that we complain about our politicians, people have been complaining about for centuries and centuries. So, thanks to Mary Beard there. That's all we've got time for on this episode. To listen to the whole Times Radio show, just go to the Times Radio app and click Listen Again. To make sure you don't miss future episodes of the podcast, subscribe on Apple, Acast, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And to read more about what we've been talking about on the podcast, go to thetimes.co.uk/timesradio to subscribe. But for now, for me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.